There's a family known as the Smith family, and they were extremely proud of their family tradition. Matter of fact, they could trace back their ancestry all the way back to the Mayflower. Along with that, within the family, there were senators, there were pastors, and there were Wall Street moguls that were part of the family bloodline. So after looking at their family history, they decided, you know what we need to do? We need to put a book together, a genealogy book, explaining all the different members of our family. So they hired this well-known author. But as they were talking to the author, they said, we got to warn you up front. There's a big problem. We have a great Uncle George who was executed in the electric chair. So I don't know how you can deal with that and kind of clean that up a little bit. And so he says, listen, I will deal with history tactfully. I'll fix it. So when he finally had put the book together and had printed the book, he brought it to the family. And the family was so curious to see what they did with late Uncle George, who was executed on the electric chair. So this is what the description of late Uncle George said. George Smith occupied a chair of applied electronics at an important government institution. He was attached to his position by the strongest of ties. And his death came as a real shock. You know, that's some control there to kind of clean that up. You know, we are looking here at a genealogy, and I think most of us here would have to admit that there's been some nuts that have fallen from the family tree. We can think of our own families this morning. I think there's probably not a family here that would not admit that there's a few nuts that have fallen from the tree. Well, this genealogy that we're looking at, it has lots of nuts that have fallen from the tree. And the most amazing thing about this genealogy is that it's the family tree of Jesus Christ the King. That's what's amazing about this genealogy. You see, we can't do anything about the legacy given to us, but we can do something about the legacy we leave for those who come from behind us. What are we going to leave to them? So here's the thought of our passage this morning. God's providence ruled and overruled to accomplish his great purpose in bringing his son, the King, into the world. And that is a description of this genealogy. Now, what we're going to do this morning is we're going to look at three areas as we look at these 17 verses. First of all, number one, we're going to do an introduction to Matthew. We're going to be in this book for several years. So we want to do an introduction and find out about Matthew. We want to find out the key verses, the key words, when it was written, you know, what's the major thought of the passages and so forth. And just look at all that and just get a really good idea about what the Gospel of Matthew is about. And then secondly, we want to look at the men of the genealogy. We want to glance at this genealogy. We want to look at the men in it. And then thirdly, we want to look at the women of the genealogy. So let's look here at this introduction to Matthew. Matthew's gospel has been referred to as the most important book of the New Testament. Now, why is this? Because it's the bridge between the Old and New Testament. Matter of fact, in between the last book of the Bible, the book of Malachi, and Matthew is called the 400 silent years. So there are 400 silent years, and it is Matthew's gospel that breaks the silence. If you go back to the Old Testament, Malachi 4, 5, and 6 says, behold, I'm going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. This was John the Baptist. He will restore the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, so that I will not come and smite the land with a curse. Matthew 1:1 reads, the record of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, and the son of Abraham. So Jesus Christ is the long-awaited king that was promised through David. This goes all the way back to 2 Samuel chapter 7. Now, the author here is Matthew. And many believe that Matthew was not his original name. Now, let me just be clear about this, is that there's no debate over the fact that Matthew, the son of our Levi, is the author of this book. This is probably one of those books that pretty much everyone is set on that Matthew wrote it. Matter of fact, it goes back as far as 140 AD to 323 AD. There are various documents that are quoted from Matthew in his gospel regarding Jesus Christ. So we can lay that to sleep. Matthew is the author of this gospel of Matthew. Now, Matthew, as we're calling him, was not probably his proper name. His name was really Levi, the son of Alphaeus, which is recorded in Mark chapter 2, verse 14. He was later given the name Matthew, which means the gift of God. And many believe that he was given that name to commemorate his conversion, that he was a tax collector, and through an experience and calling of Jesus Christ, he was brought to salvation and was miraculously transformed into an apostle of Jesus Christ. Now, that event is recorded in Matthew chapter 9, verses 9 through 17. But I want to call attention to one verse, and this is Matthew 9:9. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting in the tax collector's booth. And he said to him, "Follow me," and he got up and he followed him. Now, tax collectors were among the most hated people in Jewish society. And I want to mention four things about it. This is not in your notes, but let me mention four things regarding these tax collectors. Number one, tax collectors were considered traitors to their own nation because they sold themselves out to Rome to collect taxes from their own people. So tax collectors were looked at as traitors. Turncoats, you might call them, is what they were called. Secondly, tax collectors purchased from Rome the right to gather taxes, and the more they gathered, the more they could keep. Thirdly, tax collectors were considered thieves as well as traitors, and some refer to them as extortionists is what they were. They had a lot of leeway as to what they could charge and what they decided to do. They had a lot of authority. And then fourthly, tax collectors' constant contact with Gentiles made them religiously suspect and unclean. Jesus himself was referred to as the friend of publicans and sinners, or the friend of tax collectors and sinners in Matthew 11:19. Matthew 21, 31, and 32. So when did Matthew write his gospel? Most believe around 58 to 68 AD. So it's during this 10-year period that Matthew was probably written. It covers 4 BC to 33 AD is the period of time that Matthew covers. The purpose of Matthew is the gospel written by a Jew to Jews about a Jew. How do you like that? So Matthew's a Jew. He's writing to Jews about a Jew. And that Jew is none other than Jesus Christ, who came through the lineage of Abraham. There's no doubt about it that that's where he came from. So Matthew reveals that Jesus Christ fulfilled the Old Testament promises concerning the Messiah. Let me mention a few of them to you. First of all, Jesus' birth at Bethlehem fulfilled Isaiah 7:14. We see this in Matthew 1:22 and 23. Jesus was taken down to Egypt for safety. This fulfilled Hosea 11:1, Matthew 2:14 through 15. When Joseph and Mary and Jesus returned from Egypt, they settled in Nazareth, which again fulfilled Old Testament prophecies, Matthew chapter 2, verses 22 and 23. Now, Matthew is unique in that Matthew used 130 quotations from the Old Testament. That's including over 53 direct quotations, more than any other book of the New Testament. This is a Jewish book. There's no more Jewish book than Matthew, written by a Jew, to Jews, about a Jew. This is why he uses Old Testament, which gives to us the existence of the Jews. It gives us the existence of history that reveals the Messiah. So Matthew reaches the Jewish readers through the Old Testament. Now, God has given to us four Gospels. The first three Gospels are Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Now, I'll be technical for a moment. These first three Gospels are called Synoptic Gospels. Synoptic Gospels. The word synoptic is a Greek word that has two other words that make it just one word, and it literally means to see together. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke cover the same areas. They have the same content. All three of them are very, very similar. Now, they have some little differences because of the audience that they were writing to and attempting to reach. But those three synoptic gospels cover the basic areas. Slight differences, but they all see the same events and they all present it a certain way to the group that they're writing to. Now, we know that we have four gospels. We also have the Gospel of John. So I guess the million-dollar question is, why do we have so many gospels? Because there isn't just one gospel that can give us the life of Jesus. I love what John 21:25 says, and there are also many other things which Jesus did, which if they were written in detail, I suppose that even the world itself would not contain the books that would be written. So one book doesn't get it. He goes on as far to say, if you took all the details of what Jesus did during his 3.5 years of ministry, all the books in the world won't be sufficient. That's how much detail there is. So God has graciously given to us four gospels. So let's quickly look at these gospels. The first one that we're looking at is Matthew, and it was written to the Jews, and the theme of Matthew's gospel is Jesus Christ the King. So he starts in Matthew's gospel with a genealogy. I mean, anyone that shows up and says, I'm a king, I mean, they have to have a genealogy. You have to be able to show through your family lineage that you are the rightful king. So this is why Matthew starts with a genealogy to show that Jesus is the rightful king. This is why Matthew's gospel quotes 130 Old Testament passages. Along with that, 10 parables. Along with that, 3 exclusive miracles to Jesus the King. Mark's gospel was written to the Romans. And the theme of Mark's gospel is the servant who rules. Now, Mark's gospel doesn't have a genealogy. You know why? A worker doesn't need a genealogy. He needs a resume is what he needs. He needs someone to write a letter saying he can get the job done. So he's writing to Romans that were people of action, and they're saying, listen, if you're looking for a servant, look no further. There's no servant greater than Jesus Christ. So in the Gospel of Mark, the word immediately is used 49 times. It is a gospel of action. Then the third synoptic gospel is Luke's gospel. Luke was written to the Greeks. And the theme of Luke's gospel is Jesus, the perfect man. He's writing to Greeks that were obsessed with the human body. They're obsessed with humanity. So Luke sets out to tell us, you want the perfect man? He's called the Son of Man. He's also called the Son of God. He's the perfect God-man, is literally what he is. He's the one that meets every single need. And then John's gospel was written that we might believe. The theme of John's gospel is the deity of Jesus Christ. John has 7 signs that only God can perform. There are 7 I am statements in which he is saying, I am who I am. Only God can say that. The phrase believe is used 98 times to believe or belief in John's gospel. 93% of the content in John's gospel is unique to John's gospel. That's why it's not a synoptic gospel. It doesn't cover like the other three do, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's different. So when you take the gospels, you can kind of look at it this way. Matthew and Luke are color slides of Jesus. Mark is a motion picture, and John is a portrait to be studied. That's kind of a good way to look at the four Gospels. Now, Matthew describes Jesus as a doer and a teacher, and he uses over 20 specific miracles and six major discourses to prove it. Matthew focuses upon the kingdom. In the Old Testament, the Jewish nation was God's kingdom on earth. Exodus 19:6, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So the theme of Matthew's gospel is Jesus Christ the King. So the message of the kingdom was first preached by John the Baptist in Matthew 3, verses 1 and 2. And he's the Elijah from the 400 silent years that God would bring on the scene. Then Jesus began his ministry by preaching the kingdom of God in Matthew chapter 4, verse 23. When Jesus sent out the 12 apostles, they went out in Matthew 10, 1 through 7, preaching the kingdom of God. Now, Matthew arranged his material in topical order rather than chronological order. For instance, in Matthews 8 and 9, he groups 10 miracles together. Now, some of these miracles are a couple years apart. But Matthew arranges them in topical order in order to reveal something about Jesus or to teach us about Jesus. Now, I got to tell you this. When I teach through Matthew's gospel, it sometimes drives me crazy. Let me tell you why. I like things in order, as you probably can figure out. So it drives me crazy to have a miracle that was a year previous that we're talking about this morning. And then the one we're going to look at is 2 years ahead. That drives me crazy. Because it kind of, you have to set the stage for it. You got to talk about it and mention it and then give the other gospels to tell about it. But you keep in mind, this is not a contradiction. This is not the Bible being inaccurate. What we have here is Matthew organizing the material in topical order. He's attempting to get a message across. It's not like Mark and Luke that will put it in specific order. So I can suggest a book, and this book is a thick book. It's a lot. For any of you that really want to go deep, this is your book. The name of the book is called A Guide to the Gospels, by W. Graham Scroggie. W. Graham Scroggie, and it's called A Guide to the Gospels. I don't know if they still print phone books. It would be like reading the Orange County phone book. That's what it would be. I mean, it is so detailed. I want to say it's close to possibly 700 pages. So it's a big book, but he's got charts and maps, and he takes great pains to put all four Gospels together. He does a masterful job. You want to find out where a miracle is, you can go to that book and he can tell you. It's just an amazing amount of work that Graham Scroggie went to. Now, Matthew is the only gospel writer to use the word church, the called out ones. He uses it in Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, and Matthew 18, verse 17. Now, that's an important word to us as again, we're studying the church in Acts on Wednesday nights, but Matthew is the only author that actually uses that word church, which was Christ's plan for the future after he was ascended into heaven. The theme of Matthew's gospel is the king and his kingdom. That's the theme. The key words, let's look at some key words and key phrases. The word God is used 103 times in Matthew. Jesus said is used 98 times. Disciples, 93 times. Kingdom, 55 times. Kingdom of heaven, 42 times. And Son of Man, 37 times. Two key passages in Matthew's gospel. Matthew 2:2, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. Matthew 4:17, from that time Jesus began to preach and say, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. So what's the key chapter of Matthew? Well, chapter 12 of Matthew is the key passage in which the leaders of Israel reject Jesus as their Messiah. At that point, everything begins to change. There's this rejection of the leadership. So Jesus' style and what he begins to do is altered by that. Now, here's the outline of Matthew's gospel. Number one, the revelation of the king, the first 10 chapters, is revealing Jesus. Then number two, the rebellion against the king, chapters 11, 12, and 13. Number three, the retirement of the king, chapters 14 through 20. Number four, the rejection of the king, chapters 21 through 27. And then lastly, number five, the resurrection of the king, chapter 28. Now we just covered an overview on Matthew's gospel. We just looked at the introduction. So now let's begin to look at these 17 verses before us. And let's look at the men of the genealogy. Let's look at these men and let's pull some lessons from these men in the genealogy. It says in verse 1 of chapter 1, the record of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah. So the very first book of the New Testament starts with a genealogy. Now, I mentioned to you already, the purpose of that is if he's going to introduce the king has to have a genealogy as a background. He's got to be able to show that he's the rightful king. He has to be able to prove it through his lineage. So that is why Matthew begins with a genealogy. Now, there are two genealogies in the New Testament. We're looking at chapter 1 of Matthew, 1 through 17. And then the second genealogy is in Luke chapter 3, verses 23 through 38. Now, both of them do mention Joseph, and they are concerned about Joseph, who is the stepfather of Jesus in the flesh. But Matthew gives us the genealogy of Joseph, the legal foster father of Jesus. Matthew starts with Abraham and then ends with Joseph. So that's his way of presenting this genealogy. Luke, on the other hand, in Luke 3:23, was supposed the son of Joseph. So he mentions that. And then Luke gives the genealogy of Jesus' mother Mary. Luke's account actually starts with the reverse, in with Mary, and takes it all the way back to Adam. That's the bloodline of the Messiah. In chapter 3 of Genesis, God promised to send a deliverer, and that deliverer would come through the seed of the woman. So he traces it all the way back to Adam. If a man suddenly appears and claims to be a king, immediately we need to ask the question, what's your background? What do you mean you're a king? What's your background? And by the way, who recognizes you as a king? And then along with that, what credentials do you have that could prove to us that you are a king? And that's what this genealogy is all about. It's basically history. And I like this. When we were going through Route 66, I said this a couple of times, and I think it's a good way to remember history. History, his story. So take the word history and kind of cut it, his story. You have to add an extra S, but that's okay. You're forgiven. Add an extra S. So it's his story. And you find out that history is his story. You look at what God does through these people. I'm telling you, if I was getting a genealogy, I wouldn't have this genealogy. I don't think any of us in here would. Talk about the Smith family trying to clean up their genealogy, you know, get rid of Uncle George, you know, is because it's a nut that's fallen from the tree. Oh, you look at this genealogy, and boy, I tell you, you talk about the grace of God. So it's history. It's showing us that Jesus was involved in history. Jesus is in history all the way back to Adam. He's in history. So Jesus, the name Jesus is derived from Joshua, which means Yahweh is salvation or God saves. That's what the name Jesus means. He's called the Messiah, which is the Christ or the anointed one. And notice what he's called right from the beginning, the Son of David. Notice that. That presents Jesus Christ as the legal claim to be the King of Israel. Because God had promised David back in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 8 through 17, that through his descendants, he would have an everlasting kingdom. Of course, David died. David's descendants died. But through that lineage would come what? The King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Would come Jesus Christ. Notice he's then called the Son of Abraham. Now that presents Jesus Christ as the line of the promise of grace. We got the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 12 that through his seed, through Abraham's seed, all the families of the earth would be blessed. Reference to Jesus Christ. All the blessings of life are derived from Jesus. So verse 17 says, so all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. From David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. And from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations. So, verses 2 through 6, 14 generations. From Adam to David. Verses 6 to 11, 14 generations. David to the exile into Babylon. Then, verses 12 through 17, 14 generations, exile to the time of Christ. Now, when you look at this, if you're into genealogy, I know some of you are. There's some people here that just go, I don't know why, but some people love that stuff. I had a friend of mine that just helped put my family tree together. And he started digging around for a few hours. This guy's an engineer. He's up there. And he started pulling out all kind of interesting stuff regarding my family. And I mean, he's into it. And some people are into it. If you study this genealogy, you are going to have some issues because there are some names that are added. There are some names that are omitted. And he does so to make three groups of 14 generations. And his way of saying this is you could take all of Israel's history and you could reduce it to three categories. Abraham to David, David to exile, exile to the time of Christ. So it's really a convenient way of saying this is the history of Israel, this is the history of the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. So it's through this period of 14, 14, 14 that the Lord himself worked out through these people his wonderful plan of bringing Jesus. Now, chapter 1, verse 2 says, Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob. Now, right away, you look at those three, and we studied them some months back. And boy, I tell you, they lied. I mean, Abraham lied about his wife a couple times. Isaac lied about his wife several times. You got Jacob. The name Jacob means ripoff. That's what it means. Or trickster. He's fun to watch. I mean, he just always comes up with some little scheme or some little way to accomplish something. So how amazing that these three would be included in the lineage of Jesus. Yes, they were men of faith, but oh, they had feet of clay. They really did. Verse 3 says, and Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Now, Judah in verse 3 was the leader of the tribe of Judah, and he is named with Tamar, which was his daughter-in-law. Judah commits incest with his daughter-in-law. And that's how again, the tribe of Judah continued on that through that relationship. You got David in verse 6, the sweet psalmist, the shepherd boy that slew Goliath, the great king. Later on, David would commit adultery. Then committing adultery, he found out that he got the girl pregnant, so he had the husband killed on the front line. And then God's judgment upon David for all of this was the death of the child. But in 2 Samuel 7:16, we read this promise of God to David, and your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. And then we got Solomon, which was the son of David. He was a man that started out so humble. God says, you know what, Solomon, ask what you will for anything, and I'll give it to you. So you know what he prays for? Wisdom. I wish that I had wisdom so I could properly lead God's people. And God says, I will grant it to you. But then as time went on, oh, did Solomon get away from the Lord? This man had 1,000 wives. Most of us can't handle one. He had 1,000. Can you imagine his Home Depot list on Saturday? Oh, my God. Then his heart was turned away because he married these foreign wives. He wound up sacrificing children to false gods. God said, don't multiply gold. He multiplied gold, multiplied horses, multiplied chariots. It's hard to believe when you look at the end of his life that he even knew God. He was so far away from God, but he's included in the bloodline. Then you got Rehoboam, which is his son, in verse 7. He was next in line to be king. And he despised the people. He was a terrible, terrible leader. And so the people asked, can you kind of ease up? Your dad was pretty heavy on us. And he goes, oh, you think my dad was heavy? Wait until you experience what I got for you. So the kingdom of Israel split from north to south. Jeroboam led the northern kingdom, and then Rehoboam led the southern kingdom. And the kingdom split because of his ungodly attitude. Abijah, in verse 7, was Rehoboam's son. And the Bible says that he walked in the sins of his father. You got Jehoram, in verse 8. He walked in the ways of Ahab, which was absolute wickedness. You got Ahaz, in verse 9, an idolater who sacrificed children to false gods. And then you got this bright little light called Josiah, in verse 10. The son of Amnon, who succeeded to the throne, who reigned for 31 years, revival after revival. A wonderful individual in the bloodline. And then verse 16 says, and Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, by whom Jesus was born, who is called the Messiah. So now we're introduced now to Joseph. And this is the stepfather of Jesus. And you look at his lineage and you look who's involved in his family. Boy, there's a lot of nuts that fell from the tree. And this is the bloodline and the genealogy of Jesus. Well, let's look now at the women of the genealogy. There's prominence is given to 5 different women that are mentioned in the bloodline or the genealogy of Jesus. 5 women. William Barclay says, it's not normal to find the names of women in Jewish pedigrees at all. Women had no legal rights. She was not regarded as a person, but as a thing. And let me just say this, I mentioned this last week. There is never more of the exaltation of a woman than through Christianity. I was just blown away the other day. Some woman that was a Muslim was raped, and so you know how they dealt with her? They executed her. I'll let you think about that. Christianity is so different. The Bible tells and commands husbands to love their wives, to cherish their wives. I tell you, you don't want to be a woman to be a Mormon. You know how you get saved through the Mormon church? Through your husband. Maybe that's not a bad idea. Honey, if you want, you better be good or you're not going to heaven. Just a thought. Jehovah's Witnesses. You do not want to be in a cult and be a woman. In Christianity, Jesus elevates, and the Bible elevates women. Puts them to a place of honor, a place of love and cherishing and taking care of them. And so now he mentions these women, and it is amazing his choice of women in the family tree of Jesus. He lists five women. Three of them were into adultery. That's not real good, is it? Out of five women that he could have chose, he chose them. But he does. If you're going to include women in Jewish genealogy, I would think you'd want to take four of the matriarchs, such as Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. You know, at least pull them from the patriarchs, but he doesn't do that at all. Matthew gives the church five new matriarchs, and all of them preach the gospel of the mercy of a gracious God. You see, our past does not determine our future. Our choices do. That's important to remember. So let's look at these five women that are in the bloodline of Jesus. You talk about the grace of God. How about the first one in verse 3, Tamar? Tamar's the first one. She marries Judah's first son, Ur, and Ur was so wicked, God took his life. So, Judah, no problem, I'll let you marry my next son, Onan. Onan did what was not pleasing to the Lord, and the Lord took his life. He's got one more son, and Judah goes, well, let's kind of hold off a little bit. Can you imagine the insurance company? I don't think we're going to insure this woman. I mean, there's got some problems here. She's got issues. I mean, she's married. The two guys she married don't last very long, and they just mysteriously just drop dead. So Judah looked at this, and he says, I can't afford to lose my last son. So let's just put it on the back burner, and when he gets older, I'll arrange the marriage with it. But Tamar looked at all that, and she said, basically, it's not going to happen. So she gets this bright idea. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to dress up like a prostitute. And I'm going to get next to Judah in hopes that he will solicit me, that I can have a child through, again, the children's father. Now, this is unbelievable. This is basically a form of incest is what it is. Now, what's the lesson that we learn from Tamar's life? It is always a mistake to decide God needs you to make his will happen. Anytime we think God needs us, he's in big trouble. I would suggest something to you right now that we're all aware of. How about this war with Iran right now, or Iran? Do you know that Iran came on the scene through Abraham helping God? Did you know that? God had promised Abraham and Sarah that they would have children and they would literally, they would be like the stars of the heavens and the sand of the sea. And as years started getting on, Abraham and Sarah thought, you know what, God must have forgotten what he promised, so maybe we should help him out. You know, we got this handmaid, this servant girl named Hagar, and Sarah goes, why don't you have sex with her? And that could be the children that God was promising. You know what the fruit of that was? Ishmael, which is the father of the Arab nations. What we are dealing with today is all because of Abraham wanting to help God out. You ever help God out and it turns into a disaster? I've done it once or twice, you know. It's just a disaster. So in Genesis 38, 1 through 30, that's what happens. It's the time when they're shearing the sheep, they're getting them together, that she goes out, she knows where Judah's going to pass by, and so she goes out and dresses like a prostitute, and she, that says something about her knowledge of her father-in-law, that he was like that. And so he goes up to her and he solicits this woman he doesn't realize is his daughter-in-law. And he says, well, I really don't have the money to give to you. And she goes, well, what can you give me so that I can hold on to that as collateral so that when you get back, you can send that to me? He says, okay, well, here's a ring, here's a cord, and here's a staff. So Judah has relations with his daughter-in-law. She gets pregnant with twins. Now, when Judah finds out his daughter-in-law is pregnant, he goes, bring her here. We're going to stone this girl. We got to light her on fire. I mean, she is a wicked person. And she says, well, the person that impregnated me, I have their ring, their cord, and their staff. And he looks at it and he goes, I'm busted. I mean, you talk about the National Enquirer and you talk about the National Examiner. That's what it is. It came out. Verse 3 says, Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah. And this is through the mother Tamar, which was the daughter-in-law. You know, we can't control how we came into the world, but we can control how we handle it. And I say that because our society loves victims. Oh, victim, victim, victim. Victims get awards. There's people that sit around talking about how bad they are, trying to outdo each other, how bad life was. And we could do that. We could play the victim card. But it doesn't get us anywhere. All we're doing is making up excuses is all we're doing. We need to forget the past. But Paul says, forgetting what lies behind, reaching forward to what lies ahead. So what do we learn from Tamar being listed in the family tree of Jesus? God can make something good out of the worst parts of our lives. No matter what adversity has been thrown at us, God can make something good out of it. He truly can. I know a pastor, dear friend of mine, that he was a tweaker. Some of you don't know what a tweaker is. He was strung out on meth. He came to the Lord, and God so transformed his life. He has absolutely been incredible in the transformation of different people's lives because of his background. God delivered him out of drugs, and this person loves God with all of his heart, with all of his being. And God has used him in the most incredible way out of that pit that he crawled out of. 2 Corinthians 5:21, he made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf so that we might become the righteousness of God in him. Here's the second one, Rahab. She's called the harlot or the prostitute. She's listed in Joshua chapter 2, verse 6, and Joshua 6:25. You know what's interesting? Rahab's name is mentioned 8 times in the Bible. 6 out of those 8 times when it mentions her name, it adds she's a prostitute and a harlot. When God was preparing to send Israel into the land of Canaan, he sent out spies. And when the spies came into Jericho, their life was endangered, so they met up with this woman named Rahab. And she had faith that the God of Israel was the true and living God. She believed it so much, she risked her life by hiding the spies. And they told her that because she had put her faith in the Lord and had trusted God and had preserved their life, that when they came in to destroy the city, if she would hang up a piece of scarlet, that when they came in, that house with the scarlet thread, which is a picture of redemption, they would not touch that home. And that's exactly what happened. Just an amazing, amazing woman of faith in God. Ephesians 2:13, but now in Christ Jesus, you who formerly were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. What is the lesson that we learn from Rahab the prostitute? In spite of what I've done, the Lord can forgive me. Have you been forgiven this morning by Jesus? Do you know that there's no sin outside of God's forgiveness? There's only one sin that God won't forgive. Do you know what it is? The one that we won't repent of. God can forgive any sin. So here is this prostitute that's listed in the bloodline of Jesus. Number 3 in verse 5 is Ruth. Now, this woman, it says nothing about her being immoral. She was pure, super pure. It was a holy woman. But she was a Gentile. She was of the people of the Moabites. The Moabites were a cursed people. And they were the result of the incest between Lot and his daughters, came the Moabites. They're spoken about in Deuteronomy 23, 3 and 4. It mentions the Moabites, that they were cursed. So what was her issue? She was born to the wrong people. She'd been born in Israel. She'd been born in promise. She was born a Gentile, an accursed Gentile race that was godless. Had no control over that. That's just how she came into the world. But her mother, Naomi, was amazing as she groomed Ruth, worked with Ruth. It's a most amazing book. Four chapters. Great little book to read. But you know, there's a verse out of Ruth that's used in weddings, and it's Ruth 1:16. It says, "But Ruth said, 'Do not urge me to leave you, nor turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God.'" What an incredible statement she makes. So what do we learn from this Gentile woman being listed in the family tree of Jesus? Well, we learn that through God's grace, I can turn my back on my old life. My old life doesn't have to continue to contaminate me, and I don't have to keep bringing it up. And you see people, when you talk to them, what's the furnace? "Oh, man, did I have a rough childhood. Oh, man, I had the worst childhood in the world. My dad gave me a bicycle with one pedal." Do you remember that? Remember the Twinkie defense? This guy said he became a mass murderer because he got strung out on Twinkies. I could see Ding Dongs or something like that, but why Twinkies? But isn't it amazing? You know, he's just constant victim, 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 victim. And boy, I tell you, you look at her life and the stuff that she went through, her husband dying, she was a young widow, just all kind of stuff. Lost everything. Had to come back to Jerusalem. I mean, it's just a rough life. Could have just played that card over and over and over again, but she didn't. Number four in verse 6 is Bathsheba. Bathsheba. It says, "By Bathsheba, who had been the wife of Uriah." Now, Bathsheba is mentioned in 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 1 through chapter 12, verse 25. And I'm sure as a Jew is reading this, they're going, "Oh boy, there's a typo here. Why are we bringing this woman up? Why was she not scrubbed from the genealogy?" And you know, Bathsheba committed adultery with David, the king of Israel. When you read the account, it said it's the time when kings go to battle. David decided to stay back, which again, idle time is the devil's workshop. That's not a verse, but it's in the Bible. It really is. You got idle time, you can get into trouble. And so David's walking around, strolling on the roof, and he looks over and sees a woman taking a bath. Well, her name is Bathsheba. What do you expect? You know. So David asks, "Who is she?" "Well, she belongs to so-and-so, who's one of your best soldiers." "Oh, well." He brings her to the house, has sex with her. Then she writes him a note. It's almost like a soap opera as the stomach turns. She writes back and says, "Guess what? I'm pregnant." I mean, this would be a great soap opera. It really would. So David goes, "I'll fix it." So he calls in her husband Uriah and says, "Here, come on, get away from the battle. Spend some time with your wife," hoping that he'll have sex with his wife and that she can get pregnant and he can cover it up. But he won't do it because he's so committed to God and so committed to Israel. So finally David says, "I'll fix it." And he tells his commander, "When the battle is hot and people are swinging, put him out front by himself." So he had Uriah murdered. So when that baby was born, that baby died as a result of God's judgment. What do we learn from this adulterous woman being listed in the family tree of Jesus? You have not committed an unforgivable sin. Now think about this. God forgave them and included them in the bloodline. Later on, in Psalm 51, as David is remembering this period of time in his life, in Psalm 51:17, David says these words, "The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise." Ephesians 1:7, "In him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses according to the riches of his grace." And this brings us now to the fifth and final woman, Mary, in verse 16. This is none other than the mother of Jesus. Not the mother of God, but the mother of Jesus. Gabriel appeared to Mary with the message that she was going to give birth to the Son of God. Now, you can imagine what's running through her mind. How does a virgin have a baby? That's a great question, isn't it? How does a virgin have a baby? Luke 1:38, Mary said, "Behold, the bond slave of the Lord, may it be done to me according to your word." And the angel departed from her. You know, in Mary's day, 2,000 years ago, if you were engaged and you got pregnant, guess what happened? They executed you. That's what they did. Now, today they throw a shower for you. But back then, they executed you. Of course you throw a shower. That's what you do. But back then, they would execute. They would stone her. But she and Joseph realized this was from God. This is what God was doing. So what do we learn from Mary? When we get our eyes off of our circumstances and lift them to God, it's easier to say, "Yes, Lord." Maybe some of us today, our eyes are fixed on our problem, and it's really hard to say, "Yes, Lord." Get your eyes off of the problem and get your eyes on Jesus. That's where they need to be. So in closing, I just want to close with three applications, three things. Number one, we can't do anything about the legacy given to us, but we can do something about the legacy we leave for those that come behind us. What are we going to leave? We have no control over what was given to us, but what are we going to leave? Number two, our past does not determine our future. Our choices do. It's what we do with them. And number three, what we learn from Rahab being listed in the family tree of Jesus. What do we learn? Well, in spite of what I've done, the Lord can forgive me. Let me ask you this morning, have you been forgiven by Jesus? Do you know that you know that you know that Jesus has forgiven you? That you are the property of Jesus Christ? Do you believe that this morning? You know, you should. You should. Because if you have confessed that you're a sinner and you believe that he was God who came and died in your place, was buried and raised on the third day, then you should have that assurance that you've been forgiven of your sins. If you haven't, in a moment, you can come up for prayer. And I would talk to someone about that. Romans 8 tells us the Spirit bears witness with our spirit that what? We are the children of God. You should know that you know that you know that you belong to Jesus because the Spirit of God bears witness to that because you've confessed yourself a sinner and put your faith in Jesus. Do you know Jesus Christ this morning? Do you know Jesus is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords? Do you know that?